You're listening to a stage talk titled Investigating Protest Movements and the Police Response Using Open Sources. This week, we were joined by the researchers who worked on our latest investigation into the civil unrest in Bangladesh, my colleagues Pooja Chowdhury and Lucy Swinnanen, as well as a server community member, Eridice. Together, they published an open source overview of the final hours of Sheikh Hasina's rule, documenting police violence against protesters. In the discussion, we unpacked the investigation and shared methods that could be replicable for other protest coverage. You can find all the links mentioned in the talk in the description of this podcast. The talk was hosted by me, Charlotte Marr, on Thursday, the 15th of August, 2024, in the Bellingcat Discord server. Welcome to this week's Stage Talk. Today, I'm joined by my colleagues Pooja Chowdhury, Lucy Swinnanen, and Discord community member and research collaborator, Eridice. We're going to be discussing using open source techniques to cover protest movements and the police responses. Pooja, with Eridice and Lucy's help, has recently published an investigation to the protests and police violence that led to the fall of Bangladesh's Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina. We analysed videos from the final hours of the rule, highlighting how protesters began to outnumber the police forces who resorted to attacking citizens from rooftops. Today's talk will hopefully provide you with some insight into how you can use research techniques to effectively cover protests safely from afar, sharing tips on tools and resources that can be invaluable for this type of coverage. As we talk, please put your questions in the chat, as I've just mentioned, and I'll ask them as we move into the Q&A section. But first, Pooja is going to tell us a little bit about the investigation and how it was carried out. Pooja.
Thanks, Charlie. Hi, everyone. So about the article, I think we started looking at the protests, I want to say mid-July, but they were going on since June. But they turned violent around mid-July, and that's when we started looking at it. So students were protesting in Bangladesh against this quota, which the government had implemented. The quota was actually, it was also implemented in 2018. And there were protests back then as well. And the government had removed it. But then they re-implemented it again this year, and that led to massive protests because it assigned, I think, 30% of government jobs for veterans of the 1971 war of independence. And I think the students were of the view, the protesters were of the view, that it benefits those who are close to the then ruling party, which is the Awami League. So the students were protesting, and it seemed to be a peaceful protest, but it turned violent around mid-July when the student body of the Awami League, they held counter-protests, and the protesters alleged that they were being attacked. And then the Sheikh Hasina government, they called police on the protest. And then we started seeing a lot of videos of police brutality. The government also gave police shoot on sight orders, and we saw them using lots of ammunitions like, you know, tear gas or rubber bullets pellets against protesters. And I think one video which during like the early stages which got really viral was of this protester who, you know, stands with his arms, you know, he's widening his arms and standing in front of the cops, and then they shoot at him, and he eventually died. I think his name was Abu Sayyid, and that video was covered a lot by media organizations, and I think that was the first one which was covered by a lot of media organizations. But there were a lot of videos that we were seeing online of similar police brutality, which hadn't been covered as much. But when we started looking at it, we could not find a lot of additional details or additional footage or additional reportage. I think mainly because of a communications blackout, the government had suspended the internet. So even though we had like some footage of students and protesters being attacked, we were not able to find a lot of details around what exactly happened. Some of the ones that really stood out to us was of this protester who was the first video that we saw was he was being sort of like carried. I'm not sure if what the purpose was. I'm not sure how he landed on the top of a police vehicle. And he was being carried around the city. This was in Dhaka. And later on, in a few days later, there were other videos of the cops, just pulling him from the roof of the vehicle and dropping him on the street and then just tossing him across the divider on the road. And we were first looking at some of these videos that was specifically brutal or violent, but we weren't able to find a lot of additional details. I'm not sure why. I think because maybe because of the communication blackout, the information wasn't coming out of Dhaka. And this is so initially when we started to look at what was happening, we thought that we would do like a story on some of these videos that really stood out. And we were looking at it. We did geolocate a couple of videos where we can see the cops shooting or excess police violence. Such videos, we geolocated, I think, four or five, but there wasn't any additional information about what exactly happened before or after. And then I think in the weekend, everything just changed, right? Because the government was suddenly, there was, it was overthrown. Sheikh Hasina, she fled, she went to India. And in, I think Friday, starting Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then Monday is when she fled, there was a lot that happened. So we changed our approach and thought that it was, Lucy thought that, we should now sort of like report on what exactly led to her fleeing the country. And a lot had happened in that weekend. So we did a story on the timeline of events. And I think our story has maybe like eight or something instances, seven or eight instances that capture again police violence against protesters. There are a couple, I think there's one where I think it's an alleged police vehicle that's just runs into rams into protesters, and you can see one protester just getting hit really badly. We don't know, it's not reported. We don't know if someone died. We exactly don't know details of the vehicle. It does look like a police vehicle, but there aren't any obvious markings. And it's just a 4 second video. All the videos that we geolocated were in Dhaka because mainly in Dhaka because that's where largely the protests happened in the capital. And that's what our story is. It gives a timeline of how the protesters ramped up their protests against the police brutality that they this was actually renewed protest. They had been protesting and the government had removed the 30% quota on government jobs for veterans. But local reports say that more than 500 people had already died, even though I think Western media has reported somewhere around 200, but local counts put it at about 500. So the protesters, the students were really angered by how the government had reacted to the students' demands. So they renewed the protests against police brutality, which led to even more police brutality. And then eventually the government was overthrown. So yes, that was our story. And Lucy also did a lot of work. I think it was her idea to look at it in this manner because so much had happened. We are still trying to find out details of the videos that we were initially looking at. Some that stood out initially in July when the police was really brutal, and there's another video of someone like carrying a protester and the cops just like shooting at him even though he's clearly injured, and then the person who's carrying him has to leave him and run away because the other protester is now immobile because he's like shot, he's been shot by the cops. So we have some of these videos that we're still trying to find details of, but the story that we recently published was about the lead up to what led Sheikh Hasina to flee the country.
So you mentioned that it was amongst an internet shutdown that you were often looking for this kind of imagery. Did you find any particular search terms that were useful when looking for imagery of this kind in Bangladesh? And what kind of platforms were you seeing those content appearing on?
I think Twitter and Facebook. There were things being shared on Telegram as well. But I think just because towards the end, the government had like removed some of the communication blockages. So then we had some more footage come in, especially during that weekend. And just because there was, I think, so much violence, people were just putting out a lot of videos. Honestly, it wasn't too difficult to search. Most of the terms were as, you know, common as, say, Bangladesh, police, violence. I searched for them in English and then in Bengali as well. And people were also using some hashtags on Twitter that helped with the search. So I would say Facebook and Twitter were the main platforms where videos were being shared.
And when collecting the sources, did you come across any fake or repurposed imagery because it was such a viral story?
No, I did not. I'm not sure if there was, but I personally did not come across any videos that were being repurposed. I think now the misinformation, after the government has fallen, now the misinformation is really, really widespread because of a lot of narratives that have been circulating online of like violence against minorities and especially Hindus in Bangladesh. So now we are looking at a lot of videos that are not from Bangladesh being shared, or videos being misrepresented as, say, temples being attacked. But back when the protests were happening, I personally did not come across a lot of footage that was being placed out of context.
That's great. Something rare for a protest movement, actually. That's fabulous. Thanks so much. Ernest, I wanted to come to you just while people are putting questions in the chat and ask you what your role was in all of this. Obviously, you're a community member here on Discord. What made you interested in getting involved? And what were your biggest learnings from working with Bell Encounters project?
Yep. Well, thank you very much, Aria. Hi, everybody. So going straight to answer your questions, well, for me, it's simply like, myself, first I want to dispel things that I'm just a community member. I'm not a professional researcher, that I do this more or less as a hobby myself. And I just really curious about everything that goes on in the world. And looking into the events in Bangladesh, I was just looking into them and started to share about them in the server and so on. And just by that interaction is when, you know, I just simply got a surprise message from Lucy, and then she put me in contact with Pooja, and we started to look into these things together. So this is just what my experience is, simple as that just by being active on this server in this community, you're going to have the opportunity and the chance to eventually end up working with such a high quality team as the people in Bellingcat, right? Just as a collaborator. So, and this is something that I think that everybody can do. I just looking for trends like the one that Puya was mentioning before, police, fire, protests, etc. On social media, in both English and then on Bengali. If you don't speak Bengali, don't worry, neither do I. You can just go as simple as translating the terms and start searching them, and surprise, stuff appears on social media. So you just start looking for that information and then contributing in different ways, like can be, for instance, geolocations, chronolocations if possible, etc. what at the end of the day, what every person can do, I think, in this community is simply, I just encourage everybody to get involved in the ways that you can. You don't have to be some kind of expert or someone extremely knowledgeable or capable, as long as you are active and interacting with people and contributing positively. If your dream is to do a collaboration with Belinka, that's going to happen sooner or later, because there will be a topic that it can be interesting for them, and you know, you happen to be working on it.
Amazing. So you were sharing footage and information that you'd found online in here, is that right? And then you came across Pooja, who was already kind of looking into this kind of thing, and you connected and worked together on collecting information. Is that correct?
Yes, that's more or less how it goes. It, as I say, it's simply being active on the server as one more person, and suddenly you see that you get a message and just things start to work together. And so after that, I just kept doing more or less the same things that I was just doing already in public, just looking for some videos, geolocating them, etc. I think that's what, as simple as that, and just helping a little bit around. That's as simple as that.
Well, I know your help was very much appreciated, and we found a lot of really interesting videos thanks to your efforts. So thank you so much, Rodice. And yes, it is true. Bellingcat researchers do lurk in here. They're always lurking. So be aware of that when you're posting information in here. We had an interesting question reverting back to the disinformation point in the comments. Quality G says, is there a specific reason you feel there was less disinformation in this case? Who are the potential players that might have spread disinfo during these protests, and why do you think they didn't seem to happen as much?
That's a good question. I honestly did not notice a lot of disinformation when the protests were happening. I could just not have been looking closely. I don't know. Maybe there was disinformation. Maybe it was shared in Bengali. I do understand Bengali, but it's very rusty. I'm from West Bengal, which is a state bordering Bangladesh. So the local language is the same. I should know Bengali better, but my mother tongue is Hindi. So I did learn it in school when I was growing up. So it's, I can read a bit. I can understand it when someone talks to me. I'm very bad at it when I speak. So maybe it was me. If it was being shared in the local language, I probably missed it. A lot of the stuff that I was looking at was in English, and the little Bengali that I know helped with geolocation, because I could read some of the hoardings and other things in the background. It helped because you know, the protest was happening in the capital, so there was a lot of street view. There were a lot of markings that you could just start off from. Disinformation during the protest, again, sorry, I don't think I'm the best person to answer that, but I know right now there's a lot going on. We haven't done a story on it. I've just been like lurking. I've just been following a bit of what other people have been publishing. Fact checkers, the kind of stories that they've been doing. Recently, I think I read a story where, since there's a lot of disinformation from, you know, the Indian side saying that Hindus are being attacked. Today, I think I also saw like someone sharing a video claiming that the minorities are attacking women in Bangladesh. So there's a lot going on, and a lot of these videos are, you know, maybe not from Bangladesh, or maybe they're old. I know that's being shared right now, both in like Hindi, English, Bengali. But during the protest, I did not notice a lot.
Novel asked a follow-up question regarding all protests. What are some red flags to look out for concerning disinformation agents in regards to protests? I think they're the same kinds of spots that you look out for in general in disinformation, and that's, you know, lack of sources. So if someone's posting something without showing the source, that's a big red flag. If the footage is suddenly black and white or cropped in, it's likely to have been manipulated. Things like that. If you reverse image search, do you find it elsewhere online? These are all kind of easy things to spot. And then if you go to the person's profile, they're posting about lots of different news events. Are they always claiming to have exclusive sources? These kind of things are red flags that we look out for. Is there any others, Pooja, Lucy, that we regularly spot when it comes to kind of these big protest movements and news stories that people jump on?
I think you've covered most of them, but one thing that I do practice is, and I did during Bangladesh when we were writing up that story as well, because there were so many videos being shared, a lot of them did not have a date. So if I can't, you know, if we couldn't confirm, especially because the story was a timeline, so if we couldn't confirm when an incident took place, we didn't add it to the story. So we did have other videos as well, which we had geolocated. Editors had also sent some stuff that did not end up in the story because we couldn't confirm the date of those videos. So I think that is also another thing to keep in mind when while covering protests. If you can't confirm the date, it doesn't have to be the time, but at least if you can't confirm the date, probably best to not add it to the final piece.
I think you guys covered it pretty well. I guess something that was mentioned earlier is when people are, you know, reposting things and you don't know what the original source is. But I feel like that starts happening when there's a huge mass of posts. So, you know, in the immediate term, we're looking at things that were from the day before. So it was very quick that we were covering things that just happened. Whereas if you're looking like a week later or 2 weeks later, that's when I think you're getting more and more recycled things, and that's making it even harder to distinguish. I think the further away you get from the event, then that adds to that complication of finding the original sources.
Absolutely. Nibbles, interesting Discord name, has also wrote, is it possible that the angles of disinformation, e.g. destabilization of the government and law and order, were already being met, which means that external entities didn't need to be involved? This is also a really valid point. We've got quite a few questions coming in now. Sarah, who is one of our lovely mods, has asked a question for Erdos. Did you find similarities with Facebook use in Bangladesh, as we've seen in Congo, for example, where there is a higher use of Facebook as a primary social media? And if so, are you aware of any similar push by Facebook to offer their service free in Bangladesh?
All right. So first, to give a little bit of context, is both Sarah and I, as well as I see Johnny there as well, and a few other members of this community, we have a project where we monitor events in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And yes, regarding your question, Sarah, to be fair, most of the footage I was looking for was mostly on Twitter, as well as a site that Pooja shared with that is more locally organized by the protesters and who were compiling some footage that around the protests and violence on it. So I personally didn't look much into Facebook, even though my expectations were that there would be more content over there. And I know that Pooja was mostly looking on Facebook as well. So I think the difference was mostly that there was the other way around, that there was content available on other sites, as I mentioned, Twitter, for instance, compared to Congo. And also another factor to keep in mind is that the usage of social media in Bangladesh is much higher than Brazil and the Congo. So compared to some of the things that we have done there, looking into Bangladesh was relatively, of course, talking still on relative terms, easier to come by with the content and media. So that's probably the main advantage. And regarding your second question, personally, I am not aware. I don't know if it's something that maybe Pooja knows or anybody else regarding the offering Facebook for free in Bangladesh.
Yeah, I've not heard of that either, but maybe something to look into. Shucky Ducky's also asked, Meta recently shut down CrowdTangle, a tool widely used for monitoring Facebook content and disinformation. Its replacement, Meta Content Library, is less capable in certain aspects and restricted to researchers and nonprofits, not journalists. Yeah, Meta are not fans of journalists at the moment. Questions to the panel. Did anyone use CrowdTangle in this investigation? I don't think we did we? Just a quick answer to that. Nope. Has anyone worked with Meta's content library? I don't think so in this particular investigation. How do you view social media platforms increasingly restricting access for researchers and observers, and how might they impact investigations like this? I think that's a really nice question. Does anyone want to take that?
I can take that. I think I can rant a bit about Facebook because as horrible as Twitter search is right now, I mean, it's all over the place, but at least you can do some chronological search, which is so important when you're looking, trying to do a story on timeline covering a protest. And Facebook search is awful. Like, it does not allow you to do a time search. You can do like this week, this month, or things like that. And then I don't know if there's a this year, but you can't do like a custom time search. You can, I think, sort chronologically, but I was getting so mad at Facebook because I was looking at videos and I was trying to look them up on Facebook in Bengali, and then it was just not sorting it for me because we did find some videos which were not dated. So it would have really helped to know when a certain video started being shared online. And sometimes like Facebook is better when it comes to protests, especially in regions where Facebook is used a lot, like Bangladesh. But Facebook was so unhelpful. I think most of the videos that we ended up including in our story were from Twitter and not from Facebook. It's really sad that Twitter is also getting trashier day by day. Like you do an advanced search, it sometimes just doesn't like, it acts up. You can't scrape it anymore, so many issues. But Facebook has, I think, over the years, like, intentionally, they've, like, made it so bad to research on Facebook. CrowdTangle, I think when I used to work back in India, in fact-checking, we used CrowdTangle so much to look at where a certain piece of misinformation, you know, where all it's been shared. Now you can't do that anymore. And they have kept degrading time search, which is so helpful when you're covering things like this. I forgot what the question was. I don't know if I answered the question.
I think you did. CrowdTangle was such a useful tool, and now it's just it's such a loss to journalists and researchers alike to kind of lost that. This, I think, is one of the last questions on the actual organization of the protest, and then I would really love to go more into kind of the tools and the resources that you used. So Kudis asked, questions for Pooja. And sorry, Pooja, I hope you get a break in a second. What about the organization? Which groups seem to be having ideas what is happening most helpful during the protests? What groups seem to be exploiting the situation or pushing it astray in order to inhibit its aims? Basically, which groups are more active in working with the aims of the protest now? I'm not sure, Kudis, if you're meaning in terms of Telegram groups slash places to find information, or whether you're talking about individuals on the ground. But Pooja, maybe you can answer that with your own interpretation.
I don't think I properly got the question. Could you repeat that? Like, like people pushing their own narratives? Is that what the question is?
The first question was about which groups have been the most useful during the protests in terms of finding out what's happening, and what groups seem to be exploiting the situation.
I can answer on the useful part. I'm not sure I know the answer to who were exploiting, at least during the protests going on. There were some, I think, local channels. I think Editus mentioned we had this, I'm forgetting what the URL was, but we had this sort of like a collection of crowdsourced videos that this website had put out. And it had like a list of, like a short list of videos. And there were it was very well organized as well, because it led to the social media post. And sometimes if a news organization has covered that particular incident. So that really helped. And I think one local channel which was helpful was, it's called Jamuna TV. And I think they're very active on Facebook. And I followed some of the stuff that they had put out, and which was really, really helpful. But in general, I think people were putting out so much. I think that in itself helped. We had, I think, more than we could handle. So since we wanted the story to be timely, we did like a collection of geolocations and then put out the story. If we want, I think we could have just done a lot more. But for the purposes of the story and the timeline, I think we had enough. I don't know who was exploiting. I'm not sure. I don't think I looked at it from that perspective, because a lot of it was just, I think, people putting out videos. Right now, I think that would make a good story, like the aftermath. I think there's been like some clear groups that are spreading disinformation now. But during the protests, I did not notice.
Aradice, do you want to talk about the link that you just put in the chat quickly?
Yes. So I was just adding the link of the site that Puya was mentioning, and I mentioned before, which is a Southern Shirt, which has a simple board where people, the protesters themselves, will upload signs of violence that was being committed against them. So this was a very helpful resource to look into some footage that part of that actually ended up being in the article, right? So it was so what this shows is it is a very specific for Bangladesh, but it comes to show that how these own organizations are increasingly uploading this content available and making it visible for people, and we can use that in order to track events like this one, like protests like this one, and after, of course, verifying them and makes things easier, right? Especially now that we were mentioning how searching on social media is becoming increasingly degraded. So it was a very helpful and a very good find by Puya.
Yeah, really interesting. I'd be really interested to know if anybody in the chat or the audience has come across similar sites with other protest movements around the world. Please do comment if you've experienced that. We had loads of questions about tools that you've been using. For example, M4L has just asked, are there tools you recommend for archiving, keeping track of geo and chronolocation for social media posts? Do you use databases to keep track? Perhaps you can talk a little bit about how you archive the materials that you found and what kind of resources were really useful within this investigation.
I use Bellingcat's auto archivers. If people haven't used that, you should try to install it and use it. It's so easy. Before joining Bellingcat, I used to use, you know, Internet Archive and manually archive each link. But now there's a spreadsheet and I put all the links and it archives on its own. What tools? It was very, because this happened in the capital and there was just so much street view available, I didn't use anything beyond Google. I don't know if editors used something else, but yeah, I only used Google Maps. Honestly, the geolocations weren't too difficult, just because it happened in a city and there were a lot of markings and lots of points to go off from. Maybe like one or two took more time than the others, but it wasn't specifically difficult to geolocate incidents in this protest. So it was basic stuff. We had a spreadsheet internally where we kept a track of all the videos that we were coming across and noting down the date, the coordinates, looking it up on Google Maps. if there's street view available, and also seeing if there's any, if it's been reported by Bangladeshi news outlets. And yeah, that's it. It wasn't very fancy. We just used Google, and I just used Google. Yeah.
Yep. Just to add, since you asked Puya, I actually just use Google tools as well, Google Maps and Google Earth. Compared to other locations, for instance, in the formation Congo, it was comparatively easier geolocations. So yeah, I'm personally down to doing more geolocations in Bangladesh, because they were surprisingly easy compared to those ones. And as you said, most of them were already in Dhaka. A few of them were actually in the outskirts. There was this hotel being burned in the city of Jessore, but most of the activity was in Dhaka. So using actually one new tool that I did start using for this, and it is it's precisely the grid that was developed and published in Billingcat, precisely, that allows you to export a grid on Google Earth, and it gives you like a set of quadrants that you can discard for, that you allows you to keep a track of where have you been checking on the way to the location. There you go. Thank you for the link, Charlie. So that I have been using it now more, especially now that I'm looking into the Ukrainian incursion into Kursk. Although there's a lot of people looking to that, I personally look into it as well. It's been used there, but I started using it for Bangladesh. So yeah, it's I really recommend this tool. It's pretty helpful.
Shucky Duckies just put, what a handsome article in the chats. They might have had something to do with that guide. Yeah, it's a really useful tool, the track search grid generator. You can find it on the Bellingcat website. We've recently published it, actually, made by our investigative check team and collaborators from this very Discord. Jane had actually just asked, how do you collectively organize your research on this protest? And as Pooja mentioned, in this case, we had an auto-archivist spreadsheet that we collectively had access to, and we have been using tools like the search grid generator so that we can collaboratively work on geolocations so that we can see where people have highlighted that they've worked on already. Please do make use of these open source tools, and if you have any suggestions for new tools for collaboration efforts, particularly if you are wanting to collaborate with other people within this server, please do reach out to us, DM Modmail, or go into the tool support area of the Discord and pitch some ideas on what kind of tools you'd like developed. And we're very, very interested to hear what you think would be helpful. Please do reach out. We've had a few questions about how you kind of monitor other protests. Somebody said, regarding your methods for tracking, monitoring protests in Bangladesh, how generalizable do you think they are to protests and riots more broadly? And conversely, what must we be wary of generalizing? For example, Southport in the UK recently saw riots after three little girls lost their lives. Is there anything that we should be wary of in terms of generalizing when doing this kind of research? And do you think the techniques you used in this particular investigation are replicable for other people in other cases of protest?
Maybe not exactly replicable. I mean, there are some skills that are transferable for sure. I think people who want to brush up their skills on geolocation, protests that happen in cities are a good place to start from. Just because the geolocations are easier. And then I think once you get the first one, it keeps getting, like, it's almost like a game, right? Like, you keep getting, okay, I found this one. Maybe there's another I can find. And then you keep doing it and you keep doing it. It's not a nice thing to say that, you know, it's like real people and protests happening. But then it's easier. So it's, when you're covering cities, you get that, you know, okay, I can do this. So for someone starting out in geolocations, cities is a good place to start from. I can talk about regions that I have covered. I wouldn't be able to talk about other places, but recently I also did a story on Myanmar, And it was very different covering Myanmar versus Bangladesh. For starters, the lack of, Google Earth images. There was no street view available. Google Earth, like even satellite images weren't very updated. It didn't happen. It was much, much more widespread than Bangladesh, which was more constrained to the capital. In Myanmar, it was mostly in the rural parts. It was mostly in villages. And the villages are like really, really tiny. I didn't know the language. And Burmese specifically is a very difficult language because there can be different spellings for the same village in Burmese as well. And then when you translate it to English, it reads completely different. Because of lack of, images on satellite, Google Earth, Planet as well, I think I relied on local websites that had maps of specific districts and looked at where a certain, like I looked at, say, Google Image, Google Earth, and saw where a river is flowing, where the settlement is, how far it could be in the map that I'm looking at on a different website of the district, and trying to just like, it's a lot of like hit and miss, trying to see, could this be the place? And it isn't as easy. I think the first geolocation that I did for Myanmar took me, also I'm not specifically great at it. I think someone else might have taken less amount of time, but the first geolocation I did for Myanmar, it took me 2 weeks to find that particular village. And I was giving up. I'm like, no way I'm publishing this story. But then after I did the first geolocation, I kept getting better at it. And then it kept, I was like, okay, now I have a methodology. Now I know what to do. Just look at, maps and try to find, not Google Maps, like maps of those districts or settlements that you may find on local organizations, websites of local organizations. So it was very different. I use NASA firms a lot for the Myanmar article. Again, it depends if there's like a fire which is large enough for firms to capture it, then it's helpful. If there are small fires, they probably won't be captured. So a lot of geolocations for the Myanmar story they came from NASA firms, because if a video was being shared, I looked up where a fire was reported on that day around that time, and then looked at multiple settlements to see where it could have been. Cities have permanent structures. So again, it's easier to, even if you don't find images on Google Maps, Google Earth, which is super updated, but even if you're still looking at something from like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, there would be structures that are permanent. So it's easy to compare when you're looking at like a footage which is going viral, and then you're comparing it with Google Maps. Villages don't have a lot of permanent structures. A village that has been burned, very few points to look at. So it was much more difficult in Myanmar to do those geolocations. I was losing hope like while I was doing like one geolocation, and then CNN came up with an article, then someone else published an article. I was like, oh my God, I'm so slow. But the Bangladesh one, I'm so glad we were able to publish it in 2 weeks. The Myanmar one, I think we published it like in a month. Mainly because like I was so slow with the geolocations as well. But it really depends on where you're looking. The skills are certainly transferable. If you keep getting better at it, the more you do it. So start from cities and then, progress to much more difficult geolocations. That's my 2 cents.
Thanks so much for that. Yeah, I also think it's worth also thinking about the different models that you can put out there and publish on protests. It doesn't necessarily have to be a geolocated timeline. For example, when the Black Lives Matter protests were happening in the US, BuzzFeed produced a really useful database actually on disinformation that was trending on social media around the protests. So again, you don't necessarily have to focus in on like creating a timeline like we have in this Bangladesh piece, but it is something that is useful for people who are trying to find out what's happening on the ground. Pooja gave you some really invaluable tips just then. Lucy, I wanted to ask you actually as an editor, when looking through this kind of footage, Is there any ethical considerations we have to take into account, particularly in areas where those who protest are risking their lives? I'm thinking particularly in Hong Kong and Venezuela as well. Is there anything that we have to take into account as open source researchers when looking at this footage?
Yeah, I would say, I don't think it came up as much as this in this one, but for instance, you know, when we've done Ukraine stories, like when you're looking at posts, you want to think about if you're going to publish it, what consequences that might have for the people that posted it or what you've identified in the image. And I think, you know, that's always a tension, because the reason you're doing the story is to hold the powerful to account, and you're not doing it to expose people who are protesting or exercising that right. So I think there's a bit of a tension there, but if you are careful about it, there's no reason you can't cover these protests and do it in a way that's, you know, ethical. And I think also if you're working with local journalists or you have contacts and you can talk to people who are on the ground who are reporting on these incidents, that's invaluable, because they can give you local knowledge and, you know, give you context about what's happening and, you know, kind of the actors involved. But yeah, kind of to answer that other question about covering protests, like one thing I often do if there's a protest somewhere is I'll look back at other Bellingcat stories that we've done in the last 5 or 10 years, like Colombia, which was producing a map, or look at, you know, these different kinds of Bellingcat stories or different open source stories that have been done. And some will look really at the weaponry that's been used, and there's been some really good examples of that. So another tool that is really useful, I think, is Amnesty has done a lot of work on classifying different types of weapons that are used, who's selling them, who's buying them. And they also have like detailed records on what the police are allowed to do in certain protests, what the military is allowed to do. And you can really get into the detail of what laws have been violated by the police or the authority. So that's another thing I look at for protest coverage.
Yeah, super useful to mention that. I was going to ask about how we kind of draw the line, how we kind of say that something is police violence rather than an appropriate response, and how that differs in regions. But as you mentioned, are we referring to kind of the laws of the country and Amnesty resources, Lucy?
Yeah, I think there's a really good resource online. It's publicly available, basically, like in most countries, unless they're extremely authoritarian. You know, there are specific rules that are public about how the police should interact, what kind of weaponry they use. And even if it's non-lethal weapons like tear gas, those kind of things, there's still really strict rules around how you can use those. So I think those are really useful, because that's publicly available. That's available for the people, that's the citizens of that country, and for journalists who are writing about it. And that can be very complementary, I think, to looking at this footage and analyzing what's happened in the footage.
And for those listening back on the podcast, I'll pop some of those links in the description of this episode so you can have a look at them yourself. Solace has asked a really interesting question, and this is directed at you, Pooja. His question I have regarding ethics, especially in geolocation and reconstruction, is there any way to be more objective with our work when the incidents in question is so close to heart and to people around us? Me personally, coming from a third world country in Southeast Asia with plentiful instances of state violence in recent years, although not as big as Bangladesh, and seeing that I'm really interested in becoming a researcher slash journalist covering SIRS and human rights violence, it'd be helpful to have advice regarding this. Pooja, anything you want to say on that?
That's a good question. It's difficult to answer because, yeah, when I think there was a similar protest. I'm from India, and there was a similar, like, the violence was much, much smaller. But there were riots in the capital in Delhi, and I find it too difficult sometimes to, you know, cover it. And there was this video of, and I think a lot of times what happens in protests is that the police joins the, you know, if there are like people from the ruling party who are attacking protesters, the police, instead of, you know, trying to stop the violence, joins the attackers. And there have been accusations in Bangladesh. This constantly happens in India, that police also acts as allegedly as rioters. And there was a video that we had worked on when Delhi riots had happened in, I think, 2020, where the police had, I think, brutally assaulted these five Muslim men, and they had made them forcefully sing the national anthem of the country. It was too difficult to watch, and I gave up, and one of my colleagues ended up doing the story. And I think out of those five people who were assaulted by the police and forcefully made to, like, you know, chant nationalistic slogans and sing the national anthem, I think maybe two or three of them succumbed to their injuries. So it is difficult to cover stuff which is, you know, too close to home. And constantly you see things happening again and again and again. It's not like, you know, it's not a one-off. Like, I've seen these things happen in India so many times that you keep reporting on it, you keep seeing the violence. There were student protests related to a bill, a citizenship bill that the Indian government had come, had implemented. And there were huge protests and brutality, similar in, not smaller in scale, but similar to what happened in Bangladesh. And we were trying to track the attack against students. And some of the, you know, you speak to students and some of them were like, you know, my friends who were in university at the time, or their friends who were attacked. So it gets much more difficult the closer it is to home. Yeah, I don't have a better answer than that, but it is tough, but it's good to sometimes, you know, just compartmentalize and try to report on it and not, you know, they say that, you know, journalists, you shouldn't have biases. I really disagree with that. I mean, I will not be biased in my piece, but it's okay to have opinions. You cannot not have opinions. I don't know. Like, it's also good to have, like, editors who also, like, ground you. Like, you know, I could write something which is, you know, it sounds true to me and it has been reported everywhere. But I think while we were working on this Bangladesh story as well, there were points where Lucy said that, you know, I wanted, say, the language to be more, like, stronger. And, you know, Lucy was like, you know, maybe we link to certain sources, because there are things that you cannot say for sure, even though they may be true. So it's sometimes it's good to have, like, you know, work with editors who also can reason with you and bring you, you know, take you out of that bubble that, you know, because you're like, you're the one who's like following it so much and your opinions have been stronger. So it's good to have, like, other people work with you and tell you that, you know, this is how maybe we should write, and not, it's okay to sometimes, like, tone down, because, you know, you're like reporting on incidents. The language doesn't have to be too strong. Sometimes I think the incidents itself, they speak for themselves. So yeah, I think I would give a shout out to Lucy, because it was her idea, one, for starters, to do the story. Because I was like, okay, there's, like, I don't know, so much footage, I can't find initial details. But Lucy was like, okay, maybe, you know, we do a timeline story. And it really worked out. And she wrote most of the article, and the context and, you know, the format and everything. We were also trying to make a map to, you know, point out where incidents had happened. And Lucy was working on that as well. It didn't go to the final piece, but she did a lot of work for this story. So I think good editors, I think that really help for you to not, you know, when you're like getting emotional writing something, it's nice to have people around you who tell you that, okay, maybe, you know, we should write it in this manner.
Beautiful answer. Thank you so much, Pooja. Noble part. Existence of bias isn't bad. Hiding bias is the problem, which I think a lot of people agree with. Also in the chat, I shared our guide to maintaining mental hygiene as an open source researcher. It's a fantastic guide written by our head of research and training, Giancarlo Fiorella, who many of the people in the server know and are familiar with. Again, we're not mental health experts. We're just open source researchers, but we can speak from experience And that's what that guide does. So please do check that out. It has lots of resources for assistance to keep yourself safe when looking at this content. Final question, 3 minutes in, and you can give very quick answers from the three of you, if that's okay. From this investigation, from the Bangladesh investigation, what can people take away, what learnings can people take away to cover other protest movements around the world that are perhaps happening now or perhaps happening in the future? Eridice, do you want to go first and give your quick answer?
This does not only apply to protest movement, but anything that can be investigated with open source research. The clear message I want to transfer to people is to just get involved in the server, just start sharing the things you find and try to find ways into how you can collaborate and try to find what really is going on, right? Try to analyze it, try to identify, get into, you see that there's something going on in the world, quickly just set up a thread in the server, or at least use one of the general channels for that, and start to sharing what you are finding and try to provide what it is what you're finding there, and you know, maybe other people start to get involved, and that's how you end doing projects with other people from the community or potentially even with the staff from Bellingcat themselves. So it's just a question of just getting started. There isn't anything magical or anything like that. It's something that every person can really do. As I said before, I'm not doing this as professional or anything like that. I just do this as a little hobby myself. So if I can do it, anybody can, I guess. So yeah, just get started.
And what a hobby. Amazing. Thanks so much. Lucy, what would be your one tip?
One is just be organized and forensic. So the devil is in the detail, and the more details and that you can collect in an organized way is going to help you. And two is talk to people on the ground, talk to other people, share what you're looking at, because they might see something in footage. They might be somebody who knows a lot about X type of weapon or something, and they'll see something that you might miss. So the more people that you have looking at it and working with you, the better and deeper your understanding will be.
Amazing. I can tell you worked in journalism, short and sweet. Thanks so much. Worth also noting that we're discussing open source research in this talk on purpose in terms of approaching protests. We don't encourage anyone to kind of go down on the ground without a team of people behind them and support. So please be careful if you are ever approaching protests on the ground yourself. Pooja, last but not least, what would be your one tip? And then we'll end it.
I have a very short one. I think try to see things that are not being talked about a lot by others. I think Bangladesh was, it wasn't very actively being spoken about on our Discord. So it's you could stand out, you know, like there are things, say for instance, Russia, a lot of people talk about it. A lot of people have been covering it. A lot of people would have a lot to add to it. But there are some regions that are not covered as much. So maybe you could add to it. And this, especially like in cities where it's easier to cover, you could really, you know, bring a lot to the table and then, you know, get to work with us. And we get to work with you, which is awesome.
And on that note, we'll end. Eridice had actually mentioned Thailand in the chat. So if anyone wants to start up a conversation on Thailand today, please do in the Discord server. But thank you so much for everybody who attended this and sent the audience. Thank you so much for all of your questions. Thank you to Pooja, Lucy, and Eridice for coming and chatting to us about the investigation, about your experience covering protest movements. Thank you so much. The next Stage Talk will be in 2 weeks' time and be advertised on the server. Thank you, everybody, for joining. Thank you for listening to the Stage Talk. If you'd like to catch a Stage Talk live where you can ask the guest questions, join the Bellingcat Discord server by visiting www.discord.gg/Bellingcat.
The music you've heard is titled Dawn by Newer Self and is courtesy of Artlist.